Hey, it's Joe. Today on episode 150, I am presenting part two in my series on near-infrared light. It is becoming clearer to us all that near-infrared light, which has been stolen from our indoor lighting, is critical to our health. And demonstrating further proof of that fact is the effect that deep red near-infrared light has on eye health. Joining me today is Glenn Jeffrey, Professor of Neuroscience in the Institute of Ophthalmology, University College London. Professor Jeffrey has been producing amazing research on the effect of deep red light on eye health, and has also expanded into general health and the intricate relationship between light, mitochondria, and health. I have long worried about preserving my vision. Wouldn't it be a bummer if after all of my efforts to be a strong, healthy, athletic person for a long time, I end up not being able to see? And when Professor Jeffrey said that by the age of 70, we all have lost 25 to 30% of our central photoreceptors, even if we're healthy, let me tell you, that got my attention. The good news is there are things we can do, and we should do them anyway for our health. All right, let's talk to Professor Glenn Jeffrey. Professor Glenn Jeffrey, welcome to the Wise Athletes Podcast.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Dr. Jeffrey, I am trying to educate myself to figure out what do I need to know and then use it, you know, as best that I can. And of course, it's like an onion. Every time you think you got an answer, you just find 10 more questions.
Sure.
It never ends. And so then you have to start figuring out, what are the few things to do well and to make sure I don't do? And frankly, light is one of those things that has just sort of crept up on me as, gosh, I think this is one of the big ones.
Yeah.
Well, Dr. Jeffrey, as I understand it, you're a neuroscientist who got into studying eye health. Now, I've always heard that eyes are kind of a part of the brain, but maybe it's just the back of the eye. Anyway, tell us a little bit about your background before we get into our talk here today. And also, where are you calling in here from on the planet Earth? I assume it's planet Earth.
Yes, I'm sitting in London, on a gray winter's day, and it's kind of damp and unpleasant, and it's going to remain that way till April. So that's where I am. My background, I did my first degree in experimental psychology, and I did my doctorate in vision, and not just the eyes, but also the visual brain, where the retina projects to. And I spend a lot of time in that kind of area. I still think of myself probably as an experimental psychologist, but in the last few years, I've drifted almost towards being a public health person, really. But change is good. Change is good.
I can understand the desire to have an effect, right? You know, not just gathering knowledge, but seeing that knowledge put to use for the benefit of your fellow mankind.
Definitely. I mean, something of a transition in my lab, maybe about 5 years ago, where we started not just gathering knowledge, but taking a stance on what that knowledge could or should do in terms of health for individuals and in terms of, and you know, eventually in terms of public health. So right. I work at University College London in the Institute of Ophthalmology, but I'm right next to a massive eye hospital, and I'm drifting in and out of there, maybe 3 or 4 times a week to see various people. So I span a lot of a lot of different locations.
I am very interested in preserving my eye health. I have thought what a major bummer it would be if I somehow managed to figure out how to be a strong athletic person for a long time, you know, at 100 years old, 110 years old, but my vision is gone. I mean, dang. So, you know, if there's things that I can do now to try to prevent that from happening, I totally am interested in that. But I am also interested, I just happen to know a bit about your work. So I'm also interested in understanding and letting our audience understand more about sort of the general implications of your work in red light, near infrared light on mitochondria and just human health in general. I recently had someone you know, Scott Zimmerman, on my show to talk about his perspective about the impact of losing our access to red and near infrared light and the benefits of getting outside. But let's start with eye health. Why does our eye function decline as we get older?
I think the first thing to point out is that, you know, your natural lifespan in evolution is probably about 40 years. So most of us are living on borrowed time anyway. You know, we have health systems that keep us afloat when probably we should have died previously. But the thing that makes the retina really different is it's got an enormous metabolic rate, burns vast amount of energy. And things that burn vast amounts of energy age fast. That's a really big issue. So by the time you're 70, you've lost 25 to 30% of the central photoreceptors in your eye. Now, it happens very, very slowly. One goes here, one goes there. So you don't notice it. It's not like dropping off a cliff. But the point is that when we test your vision, by the time you're 70, your visual system's not in a good place, even if everything's worked relatively well for you.
So I could be healthy, but still my eye function is way down.
Your eye function is way down. And it's one of the reasons why, I don't know what it's like in America, but in the UK, you reach 70 and you've got to readdress the issue of your driving license. They're starting to look at how good your vision is, particularly at night. And that all makes sense. So we've got this, I refer to the retina as pretty much as a sports car. It goes like crazy. It burns vast amounts of energy, but it also has a frailty in it. And that frailty is it needs a hell of a lot of looking after. And there are some respects in which you can't look after it. We can dent some aspects of aging, but we can't always claw it back in the way that we would like to. So life expectancy continues to expand, but you've got to live with a visual system that probably isn't keeping pace with that expansion.
Okay. I think I heard you say two things there that I wanted to clarify. One was that once the damage is done, it's hard or impossible to claw the damage back to get it, you know, to a non-damaged state, but that slowing the damage, maybe that is something that's possible.
Yeah, yes. So anyone that comes along and tells you that they're going to give you your visual system back the way you had it when you were 18, don't believe a word of it. What we can do is we can take some cells in your retina that are still there, and maybe they're on crutches, they're not working very well. We can pick them up a bit. And we can certainly slow down the pace of degeneration.
Oh, good.
But we can't give you back anymore. You know, that's not possible.
Okay, so we should start early and try and do this slowing down effect as soon as we can, so that because once the damage is done, once the receptors are gone, they're gone.
They're gone. And people keep talking about stem cells and things like that. And you know, the hardcore scientists sit here and say, prove it. Because, you know, you can use stem cells on some parts of your body and it's terribly exciting. But to use stem cells on the retina, I mean, you know, that's still beyond reach. So look after it.
Okay. And so how do we look after it? I mean, I think where I want to get to here is the work that you have done on using certain spectrums of light to, you know, rejuvenate the mitochondria in the retina. And so when you say that the retina is one of or the highest using energy using tissue in the body, I assume that you're talking about mitochondria.
Yeah.
So what can we do to help that mitochondria to produce more energy or make less reactive oxygen species or, you know, whatever it does that will allow us to slow this rate of aging in the retina?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the first thing I would say, it's a preamble to this, is that your retina suffers with all the same things that your heart suffers with. So, you know, greasy sandwiches, far too much sugar are things to be avoided. But when it comes to light, it's an analogy I continue to make, is that you need to look after mitochondria so that they can carry on generating the energy that you need. Because when the energy levels go too low, cells start dying. It's like there isn't enough energy for them to do their housework. And so you start to get a problem. The big issue is, and that we've discovered really in the last 10 years, is long wavelength light, most of which you can't see, deep red, infrared. Mitochondria absorb it, and it actually improves the ability for them to make energy. If we look at the other end of the spectrum, deep blues, violets, around 400 nanometers, that takes the energy out of the battery. So that's fairly clear. I think we've all got that now. No one's going to argue about that. But the context of it is that when you're walking outside, you're walking in sunlight, great balance between blue and red. And you've been walking outside for millions of years. Mm-hmm. Domestic environment, our built environment with LEDs has changed radically. All the red's gone. So we don't get any deep infrared anymore. And so we're sitting here with our retina, which is stressed, you know, using lots of energy, but its battery is not being helped by the environment in which we're sitting in. So you sit in your office all day, maybe like in London at the moment, I'm not going to see any daylight now until first thing in the morning. I'm reliant on artificial lighting, which has very little red in it. Well, it's not actually perfectly true because I changed all the light bulbs in our labs and I've stuck loads of deep red light into them. And it looks nicer, I must say, if nothing else. But that is the fundamental problem. Light regulates the way in which we generate energy. The energy level goes too low, cells die, enough cells die, we die.
Well, that's not what we want. And I've also already said that I don't want my retinal cells to die either. So we're saying that this relates to the cells in my body and in my eyes' ability to make energy. And as I lose my health, let's just say due to aging, the mitochondria in my eyes do not function as well. And some of them maybe don't make enough energy to stay alive. And so then they die.
Yeah.
And maybe while it's happening, I can't even tell that it's happening. It's happening so slowly. And my brain, of course, is, you know, taking all these dots and then drawing a picture from it. So it's continuing to draw pictures, and it knew what things looked like because I could see very well for a long time. So it can tell me that, oh, that's a chair and here's where it is. And so it takes a long time for there enough things to be missing that now I'm bumping into things. I didn't even know that I couldn't see it.
Exactly.
I thought I could see it, but now I'm bumping into stuff.
Exactly. You can lose vast amounts of your visual system and you don't know you've lost it. And the brain and the retina are very often fighting one another. So if something changes at the retinal end, the brain will turn up or turn down the gain so that it stabilizes that image as it to what it thinks it was before. So, yeah, you can lose if you lose vision over a slow period of time, you are almost completely unaware that it's gone. If you lose it dramatically, so you have a retinal detachment or something like that, you know about it. But very often you've got to put your finger in front of yourself and start mapping things out. And you go, oh, yeah, hang on. That bit far out there on the left-hand side, oh, well, I can't see that quite as well as I used to be able to see it.
Yeah.
I have very occasionally a migraine, and that migraine is associated with a little bit of a loss of visual field. And I hadn't really noticed it, but then I was sitting on a train and I was looking up and I realized I couldn't read the station notice. I couldn't read that it was platform 5. I mean, very luckily, half an hour, I was all back to normal. So it happens. But you know, it was only because I was tested. I was going, what platform am I on? Let's look at it. I could have walked along and probably barely known that I had a transitory problem.
Wow. When I was a kid, I remember that there was a funny little test that they would do where they would put a piece of paper with a dot on it, and then you would move it to like your upper right or, you know, the upper area, and it would vanish in your field of vision. Of course, when I wasn't doing that. And like, even now, I don't see a blank spot in my field of vision. My brain fills that in.
Yeah.
So it's all true, even in, you know, my personal experience, that the brain really offsets that. But okay, that just means that you can't tell that this is happening. This may already be happening. It is probably already happening, and I just can't tell. And so I really want to slow that down so that it doesn't get to where I can tell, and I'm bumping into things, and now I can't read a book maybe, or, you know, I can't drive my car anymore, or, you know, whatever the terrible, unfortunate consequences of this macular degeneration. But you've done work on using red light. Tell us about the red light on the eyes and the mitochondria in the eyes and what you know or think is happening.
Well, we can. Okay, so let's walk around with the assumption that you're spending your life not outside. You're spending a lot of time inside. So that red light's been taken away from you. It's no longer present in your environment. What we did is we just came back in and we brought in the red light. So we did a lot of that in experiments on things like flies and bees, but we translated it straight over to humans. And if you take a group of humans who, you know, work in buildings like we do, and you give them a burst of red light, I mean, it's quite deep red, and you test their vision beforehand, and then you bring them back later, you get an improvement in their vision. What we were testing, we were testing the ability of people to look at the contrast of a color. Sort of, let's say a blue A letter on a noisy background. Okay, we got big improvements on that. The improvements varied between people, and we're still not quite sure what that's about. We're not quite sure what it's about. But it is definitely the case that we have never had anybody in our lab where we've given them a burst of red light and they got worse. A few only get better by 1%. Some get better by 20%.
Wow.
And I'm not sure what that difference is about. I've asked 1,000 questions and I'm still not there. But proof of principle, if we give you back the red light that the world has taken away from you by being in a building with an LED lighting that has no red, then yes, we improve your vision. That is no longer really open for debate. That's definitely the case. How much red light? Not really quite sure. So we can give you 3 minutes of red light, and we can detect within 3 hours that your ability to discriminate contrast of colors has improved significantly. We can then test you every day, and we find that that'll stay with you for maybe 5 to 7 days before it starts to become eroded. So if you think about how much, you know, can I have red light to improve my visual system? Yeah, sure, you can do that. That's not difficult. Give yourself a burst of red light every morning when you're sitting in your kitchen having a cup of coffee or you're brushing your teeth, and there will be an effect. So we need to bring, I keep saying to people, we need to bring sunlight back into our lives in buildings. But that's difficult. But the effect is there. It's there. It's highly conserved. So if I do that exactly the same thing with a fruit fly or a bumblebee, I get exactly the same response. So it's something in nature which is very, very deeply embedded in our evolution, our relationship with sunlight and with longer wavelengths. It's not hard to bring it back. And the consequences of that, we know, are that the way in which the cells in your retina die with age, that is slowed down. Okay, so the pace of cell death in the retina is slowed down. Now, you may not notice it, but I think if I take you at 55 and I give you a burst of red light every day, and you could compare yourself with when you were 80, you probably would notice the difference.
Okay. And somehow this, you believe or you know that this is connected to the mitochondria in the retina?
We do. There's a whole series of ways in which you can look at this. You can look at some mitochondria in a dish and you can shine lights at them and you can see how they change. We also have, as we work with biomed engineering, and the thing that's interesting about mitochondria is they change their color depending on how much reserve they've got. So a bit like you and me, you run up the stairs and you start to get a bit red. Now, we can shine a light in the eye, a very, very dim light, and we can look at the reflection that comes back. Retina packed with mitochondria. Now, if we challenge the mitochondria and we get them to do things, we can see how well their battery is topped up. And we can see that really, really quickly. We don't have to touch you. We just ask you to keep your head still. Open your eyes. We might dilate your pupil. So we see directly these big color changes that are coming from mitochondria. We know they're coming from mitochondria because we watch them in a dish. So we then translate that to doing it in your eye, and we can do it in your skin. We can do it in any part of your body. Watching that color change that tells us how good your battery, how well charged is it? Might you have a problem in the future? So could we potentially use this as a diagnostic? That's one way we're going, because if you take things like macular degeneration, it has a mitochondrial basis. Mitochondria are not the only things that are driving it, but they're a good indicator that things aren't going well. So what we'd like to do is produce relatively cheap devices that can be in an optometrist or in an ophthalmology department, and you go, and just before your appointment, you have this kind of this check of your car engine. What are your mitochondria like? Let's let the physician know as you go into the your appointment.
How interesting. Okay, the body is very complicated, but mitochondrial health is one of the 12 hallmarks of aging. It's a fundamental feature of the decline in people's health as they get older. In fact, I'll say that it's the number one thing I work on in my own personal efforts to try to remain a strong, healthy, athletic person, is making my mitochondria as healthy as I can. So this is particularly interesting to me. Before I jump a little further ahead, I wanted to go back to this macular degeneration. How common is this? I've heard you say 50% of people who reached 120 would have it. But what would you say? How common is it?
Okay, I'm sticking my neck out on that one, obviously. it gets commoner in a society that's aging. Obviously, any aging disease becomes more prevalent as we get older in a population.
Yeah.
A number of things run it. A number of things drive it. Our diet certainly has something to do with it as well. If you look at the incidence of macular degeneration, say, for instance, in Japan before the war, it was relatively low. The change with diet, the westernization of diet in Japan, has played a role in an increase in the incidence of macular degeneration in that population. Their diet was pretty good. So I don't know how, you know, I make that figure, you know, almost in a sense of drama to get people's attention, but it's going to be roughly true. But the question is, where do you, you know, you're right about talking about hallmarks of aging, and mitochondria, I think they're one of the best hallmarks of aging that there is. Where do you draw the line between aging and disease?
Right.
You know, so you know, if I've got you and you're 120 and you're still standing in front of me, do I call your degeneration a degeneration disease, or do I call it's the aging process?
Yeah.
I think that macular degeneration just accelerates it all. Something tips over and the mitochondria and the retina go, can't deal with it. I might have dealt with it a little bit better if you'd not eaten 15 pancakes every morning for the last 7 years. But, you know, it's a combination of things. But looking after mitochondria, I'm exactly like you. I actually really care about my mitochondria. I get up in the morning, I'm making my coffee in the kitchen. There's a red light on there and I'm bouncing around. I'm bouncing it off the walls. I'm not staring at it. I don't need to stare at it. I'm just bouncing it off the walls, and it's in my environment. I then cycle to work, and I'm cycling south, so I'm heading towards the sun. But I actually, this time of year, you're not getting much sunlight. One of our big problems in terms of health and light was we left Africa. You know, we evolved in Africa. We had a 12-12 light-dark cycle. yearly. It hardly changed because we were so close to the equator. And we did that for 4 million years. And then we left and we came to grey environments far north and far south. And so, you know, I'm complaining about the fact we're not getting enough sunlight, but in essence, perhaps we migrated to places that we're probably better to avoid, really.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I have to say that I had been convinced in the recent past that mitochondria is the key thing. Anyway, this is just an opinion of an uneducated person. But the reason for it is that the maintenance of my body is expensive. My body has to spend, I mean, you know, if you think about the calories, if I'm burning 2,000 calories a day, let's just say that that's the number before my exercise. Well, if I burn 2,000 calories exercising, that's a lot. I work really hard to do that. So my body is doing a lot. Now, if I burn 2,000 calories, say, in 4 hours, and my body's spending 2,000 calories over 24 hours, it's not burning it as hard as I would have in my really hard exercise. But it's doing a lot of things, obviously, if it's burning all of those calories. So there's a lot of work to be done. This is the conclusion that I've come to. There's a lot of work to be done to rebuild things, tear things down, repair things, you know, process the foods, process the air that I'm breathing, you know, all of those things. It's very expensive. And the part of my body that is taking all of the inputs, the air I'm breathing and the food I'm eating, and turning it into a form of energy that my body can actually use, is the mitochondria. So the mitochondria, think of that as sort of like the engine of the car. Anybody who's been in a little car loaded with people and trying to drive up a steep hill will know that it does not matter how hard you push on the gas pedal. You just are not going to go any faster. It's just, you're barely making it. So eating more food when you don't have enough mitochondria just means you get fat. It doesn't mean you get more energy. So we need our mitochondria. And this idea that shining light, sunlight, let's just say, or red lights in my eyes, or and before we finish today, I want to talk about just like red light anywhere on my body, because I know you did a study about that. That just shining light somehow makes my mitochondria make more energy is sort of astonishing. It's almost crazy. How could that be? It's not, you know, I'm not a plant. You know, I don't have photosynthesis. What is happening there? Do you know?
I think we have problems when we talk about light and our bodies, when we move away from our eyes, or we're not talking about a plant. So if you take a biologist and say, we're going to talk about light and bodies, but we're not going to talk about plants, and we're not going to talk about your eyes, and you're suddenly walking into a room where there's a vacuum, you know, what's going on here? The other thing people don't quite grab and they don't quite understand is those longer wavelengths, they penetrate really deeply, really deeply. So we take, this summer, we've taken a number of people and we stood them out at the back of the Institute of Ophthalmology, and we've asked them to pop their tops off and stand in front of the sun, and then we put some very sensitive measuring devices on their back, and we can measure long wavelength light coming out at the back of their body. Now, not very much, you know, it's the order of a, you know, less than 1%. But that means that all the red light that's going in is being absorbed. And we're just getting the little bit that's left over that tips over, and we measure it on the back.
And it suggests that if any of it's getting out the back, then it's definitely making it all the way through and touching all the tissues everywhere.
Yep. Your liver's getting it. Your lung's getting it. Your heart's getting it. Your brain is getting it. Mm. So That's a really telling experiment, because it's that walk, and your clothes are not a barrier to long wavelength light. So that means that walk in the park actually is a special event. I mean, as long as you're not wearing rubber or metal, that light is penetrating your body. The mitochondria in your liver are experiencing that light. Even a dark tissue like the liver is experiencing, or your muscles are experiencing it. And I know, you know, I've got colleagues who, it's not exactly my area of research, but they're saying, well, what about a fetus? And I'm going, well, yeah, you know, a fetus, particularly late stage fetus, when the skin gets really thin, loads of infrared light when, you know, a mother walks out in the park. It's just that this is a piece of information someone seems to have put on a shelf and we've all walked away from it. You know, there was a certain kind of limited understanding of it at some point, but we've lost it. And that's a great pity.
And I've heard you say that in your experiments, you don't get a dose response. So it's not like a source of energy. It's more like a signal. You get enough and the body says, ah, this is the time of day it is, or I'm now in this sort of an environment, and so I should react in a certain way. Am I understanding that right?
No, you definitely, and that's another confounding factor. When you talk to biologists, they don't like light animals when you take the eyes away. They also automatically feel that there has to be some kind of dose response curve. I've got a bad headache, I'll take two aspirin instead of one. There is a switch. Now, this causes problems in our understanding. The light is doing something. Let's say the light is releasing an enzyme, okay? And it's a trigger. It's a switch. I can give you a broad range of intensities of infrared light, and I'm still getting the same effect. So, you know, you don't have to – I see these massive panels that cost $3,000 or $4,000 of red light that people purchase. You're probably wasting your money. You're really wasting your money.
People hate that.
You are wasting your money. In fact, and I've said this a number of times, so I'm sorry if people are hearing it again, you know, we had a lovely lady who we had to reject from a clinical trial, red light trial. And a couple of weeks after we rejected her, she turned up in my office a little bit disgruntled. With a red LED and a battery, and she joined them with her fingers and stuck it in front of her eye and said, Glenn, is this going to work? And I was a bit shocked, actually. And one of the people in the lab took it away and measured the energy, and they measured the wavelength, and they said to her, that's going to work. So you don't need big expensive things. Oh, you don't need anything because you can walk outside. Mm-hmm. But you don't need big expensive panels.
Okay. And since we're talking about panels, it's something we chuckled about before we hit record. You have discovered that the time of day in getting your red light to get this effect, the time of day matters.
Yeah, yeah. Well, why shouldn't it matter? You know, your body's got all these clocks, and mitochondria have got their own clocks. But the mitochondria, these really... a cascade of things happen to you when you wake up that you're now relatively unaware of. Your hormones are all changing, blood sugars are pumping up, and your mitochondria are producing. That's when their peak energy production is for your mitochondria. So you're producing large amounts of mitochondria. Now in the afternoon, your mitochondria, I don't know what they're doing, but I think they're doing something else because they don't care about light. It has very, very limited effect on them. So I put it in an evolutionary context, and that evolutionary context is really about – and the same true of the fly, okay? The fly, it's got to be that time of day. When the fly wakes up and you wake up, you have a common problem. You've been asleep for a while, and while you're asleep, you're vulnerable. Someone could be watching you. Something could be going on. So when you wake up in the morning, you need to be able to hit the road and you need to be able to run. You need to be able to do something. And that is part of the reason for, I think, this peak in mitochondrial activity. And it's only when mitochondrial activity is dynamic, it's going up, that you can push it, right? When it's running on a plateau, you can't do very much to it. So that we get this big peak early in the mornings in mitochondrial activity, and then we can play with it. It's talking to us. But you can't play with it at night, and you can't play with it in the evening or the afternoon.
Okay, so this gets back to things we've been hearing about. We haven't really understood it, but if you can get light in the morning, that's good. You know, for circadian rhythm reset, for you know, whatever. You know, you want to go ground, well, good, do it in the morning and get that sunlight in the morning, because that's when your mitochondria are receptive to getting the red near infrared light from the sun. Or if you're using a panel like me, and I've been using it in the morning and at night, well, I'm going to keep doing it in the morning.
Yeah, you do that. You do that.
Okay, so proof. Proof that this really matters. I mean, we talked about how, you know, we moved out of Africa and now we're living in places that aren't really perfect for our evolution. You know, but, you know, we don't find Norwegians just dying, you know, at 21 years old because they're not getting much light, you know, in certain times of the year. So there's all kinds of confounding factors. It's hard to see the effect here, except maybe in our eye, and I get macular degeneration, you know, when I'm 70 years old, you know, if I haven't had enough red light. But what proof do we have that this really is affecting human beings?
Yeah, good. It's an important point. Human beings are, in many senses, a major pain in the neck because each individual is an individual and we're also different. We're genetically different. We've got different habits. We do different things. But if you look on the population basis, right, the further north you live, the higher incidence of certain diseases. And those diseases are diseases that have associations with mitochondrial disease.
Wow.
So MS, you know, it's very clear. It's been charted across Canada. Further north you live, greater the incidence. And if we look at the population basis, if we forget about necessarily where we live, but we take different groups of people, and some of these studies have got thousands of people in them, which is great because you need that because they're all so different. You find that those people that are spending a lot more time outside have got much better control over their blood sugars than people that are inside. If you look at total deaths in populations, and it's certainly true for cancers, that the total number of people that die of cancer and cardiovascular disease is greater for those that are sort of embedded in the built environment as to those people that spend a lot of time outside.
Wow.
But of course, there's lots of confounding factors. You know, you've got to do stats on very, very big numbers to get this out. But if we take a step back from the human and we go back to things like insects, they live significantly longer if they have bursts of red light. Significantly longer. In fact, what we find is that in insects, those middle-aged deaths go. So instead of the patterns of death with age going down very gently in a very, very linear manner, they chug along at quite a, you know, they're doing very, very well. Not many people die in their middle age. And then suddenly as you get to the end, bang, you get a large number of deaths. Mm-hmm. So it's not that absolute lifespan is changed, but absolute doesn't change, but the average does change. So all short-lived animals that we've looked at, we've got rid of a big chunk of middle-aged deaths. So
that's interesting.
I think there's a weight of evidence that makes it really difficult to ignore. You know, you can't really ignore that. And then you look at the human data and you look at where people are. I should point out that, you know, Norwegians are apps. I used to work in Norway a lot. They're a terrible example to use because they eat enormous amounts of fish.
Oh.
Right. So that already makes them pretty different.
Okay.
And a lot of that, and the price of alcohol in Norway is a crippler. So, you know, they're all.
So they don't drink.
Well, I think they probably binge drink, but you know, you if you go to a bar in Norway, you better have your credit card with you because the alcohol is taxed at an enormous rate by the government. So how do we compare these people?
Yeah.
Very difficult.
And wasn't there a, I think I've heard people talk about NASA finding that astronauts who sort of are in this sort of weird environment, this manufactured environment where they're only getting, they're not getting sunlight, you know, even though they're closer to the sun, they're hiding from it as well as they can. They're not getting these red spectrum lights for a long time, that there's some effect, or at least there's a speculation that that's why they become unhealthy.
I think it's not speculation. I mean, we've got a confounding factor again, which you've got weightlessness. But yeah. NASA, in a big publication in a very prestigious journal, Cell, they said, we've got a problem with our mitochondria in our astronauts. Now, two key things came out of that. You've got to remember these people are super fit, and their physiology is being monitored all the time. The first thing that happened was that they were becoming pre-diabetic. Now, diabetes and mitochondria hold a hand very tightly, because mitochondria, they need their fuel, and their fuel is blood, is sugar in the blood and oxygen. So if you slow a mitochondria down, no red light, lots of blue light, it will use less sugar from the blood. It'll use less carbohydrate. Consequences, blood sugars go up. So we know that red light can control blood sugars. The second thing, which is even more surprising, is that they were monitoring people up who were up there for 6 months. They said they're showing signs of premature aging. Now, remember, mitochondria control aging. Mitochondria control cell death. We've now got a really bizarre profile going on. We've got people are not questioning the data. So we've got people in space that are becoming pre-diabetic, even though they're very fit, and they're showing signs of premature aging. Well, the paper was a great paper. It was very impressive. It had so many authors on it, all different specialists. But after that, NASA went very quiet. They went very quiet, I think, because they want to unload the long-distance space flight going to Mars, places like that. They want to unload that commercially. So is a commercial company going to take on a project where the astronauts age faster? That's not in their health insurance policy. So that, I think, is particularly interesting. That it's a great example of mitochondria potentially controlling the pace of aging. We know they can do that. We know if we've got a small experimental animal, we know we can increase their rate of aging if we give them loads of blue light and no red. And this is just that natural experiment in space.
Interesting. Okay, so let's dive into that a little bit. You know, this whole blue light thing, it's really kind of taken on a life of its own. Everybody's wearing blue blockers, or you got to watch out for the blue light before bed, or you won't make melatonin. When I got some glasses, they wanted to know if I wanted to get a film put on them that was going to block blue wavelengths of light. So is blue light bad? I mean, you just said yes. If you're just getting blue, then it slows down your mitochondrial energy production. And I've heard that it increases stress on the body. Your cortisol goes up.
Yeah.
But is, you know, if we're getting like lots of sunlight, do I have to worry about the blue part of it?
I don't think you do. Are people in Africa going blind?
You know, I don't think so.
The answer is no. Are people in, you know, winter in Norway where there's snow and there's very, very high reflectivity of short wavelengths? No, they're not going blind. It's a matter of a balanced point of view. I don't think the blue is an issue. I think the absence of red is an issue and an unbalanced light environment. A few years ago, we all went round with yellow glasses. I thought, you know, come on, let's generate some hard data here. You know, I had people walking around with yellow glasses and I wasn't getting a result. So then I started taping yellow film across their faces. And everyone knew that Glenn was doing another ridiculous experiment. We didn't get it out. We didn't get a result that we really expected. Huh. We didn't get a result. We just got a lot of noise. I don't know what to think about the blue blockers. We've also had people sit in front of blue monitors for long periods of time and tested their vision. It's roughly okay. Uh-huh. So blue blockers, we've discussed this for hours and hours. I was strongly minded to believe that a blue blocker in a LED lit environment would be beneficial.
Okay.
Bob Fosbury, you know, one of our physics kind of guys, come and said, well, you know, you've got these yellow glasses and you think they're blue blockers. They're only blocking a percentage of the blue light. They're not blocking all the blue light. So, and then, you know, blue blockers, you've got glasses. That's not stopping blue light coming in around the sides.
Right.
So this needs, that issue needs a very, very tight and quite extensive series of experiments to do it. But why don't we do something else instead? Why don't we just bring red back into the built environment and we can walk away from that problem?
Yeah.
I must say that I think it's all about the blue-red balance. Everything is. So there's been talk here, and we work really quite extensively with architects. And the architects are coming in saying, we've got a problem with this blue light in buildings and LEDs, and particularly in hospitals. So if you've got a chronic care unit where you've got people flat on their backs, and invariably there's hard white LEDs, but they've come around to the point of view. The point of view is just reintroduce the red. Okay? Just reintroduce the red. Because the red's going to go through all the blankets. It's going to, you know, it's going to penetrate quite deeply. The argument has got twisted. It's not the blue, it's the absence of red.
Okay. Well, the problem with LED is, like, I have a lamp and it's got four wavelengths is what it claims. Two in the 800s and two in the 600s. But maybe it would be better if it was a more of an incandescent bulb type of a thing, where it's like all the wavelengths.
Completely. We've got a big area of my university, UCL. Got a big building with no daylight. Fantastic, perfect experiment. They're all under LED lighting, and it's quite harsh. And it's a big building, a big space where architects make models and where heavy engineering stuff goes on, big machines making thumping noises. And I tested their vision, and then I went round and I put incandescent light bulbs in, and we got a very significant improvement in visual function. Now, I didn't do anything. I didn't say you've got to look at this light bulb. I just said, make this part of your life for 2 weeks. Go make a cup of coffee, go and have a chat with someone over there, but just make this light part of your day. And yeah, the result was so dramatic, I insisted on the fact we replicated the whole thing with another group of people. some results you think, if I publish that and I'm wrong, I'm going to be skinned alive by Philips or Osram or one of the big lighting companies. But it was absolutely fine. Now, I think here's a really interesting thing. In America, I think either now or very, very shortly, you're going to have incandescent lights banned. You're just not going to be able to get hold of them. Scott Zimmerman he's walked around that problem. And I think he's done it in an incredibly clever way. He's taken an LED light and he's put a little incandescent coil in it. Now, it's run at such a low voltage, it's not generating that much energy. It's not generating heat, which is a big argument against incandescent lights. They generate heat, they waste energy. Mm-hmm. This thing consumes relatively little energy, but it does produce a big extension on the infrared spectrum.
Ah.
I emailed Scott earlier on today saying, I need a bag of these bulbs because I actually want to now test them. I've done the incandescent. I know what the result is with the incandescent. I'm not going to win with governments over incandescent. I'm just not going to win.
Yeah.
So if we're not going to win, what's our best way round for public health? It might be with Scott's, is it an invention? I don't know. Scott's idea about lighting.
Yeah, yeah. What he had said was that the problem with the incandescents was that they didn't put out an even amount of blue and red. They put out mostly in the red.
Yeah.
And so you had to turn it up really high in order to get enough visible light out of them. And that meant that they were hot. And also, they didn't last very long.
Exactly.
So what he does is he turns it way down. You get like hardly any visible light out of it. But then he puts an LED in there. So you get visible light and then you get the red and the near infrared and I don't know what else in this bulb that's a combination of things. And because it's turned so far down, he says, it never wears out.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's a very interesting engineering solution. So I'm going to get a box full of these things. And so what we're going to do is we're going to test them on people. Can I improve your vision with this? Because I'm not going to win against governments and incandescent light bulbs and waste of energy. So This is kind of quite an interesting thing, because it's like two warring parties. It's the compromise between the two. You keep your LED, but then you've got this tungsten filament in there, which will last an enormously long period of time and will generate a healthy light spectrum for people.
Yeah. Okay. I got to get me one of those. Yeah. I mean, I used to have a white LED, like a seasonal affective disorder light at my workstation. You know, like what I needed was more bright blue spectrum light coming into my face, sitting in a building that had nothing but blue light. And of course, you know, I'd end up getting a headache from the thing.
Yeah.
But I thought, oh, it'd be, you know, it's stimulating. It'll give me energy so I can. It was doing exactly the wrong thing for me. I need one of these infrared, near infrared devices to give me the effect that I wanted. So I see that we have run out of the time that you've given to me. So thank you for that. Anything else that you would like to say to our audience here, and then tell our audience how they can find you, more information about this topic?
Yeah. That is one simple message. Go outside.
Yeah.
Just go outside. Why don't you build into your life that hour walk, you know, which is going to improve your cardiovascular system. It's going to improve your mitochondria, and don't have a large meal and sit on the sofa for the next 3 hours. So It's very, very simple. And as I say with most of my podcasts, it ruins my Sundays beyond belief. But I'm here, right? Glenn Jeffrey, you can find me. I'm at University College London, and I do my absolute best to respond to people.
Awesome.
Because government pays my salary. And as I now describe myself, I'm part of the public health system.
Nice. Dr. Jeffrey, thank you very much. This has been really great. I hope people take this to heart. I am definitely making this a big part of my health program. You know, I'm trying to de-emphasize how many chemicals I'm putting into my body, and I'm going to try to let my body's basic infrastructure do its thing by giving it the signals that it is used to getting, you know, in the millions of years past. And that I have not been giving it because I've been living a modern lifestyle. Have a great day.
Yes, thank you very much indeed. I've enjoyed the conversation.
Yes, so have I. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for joining my conversation with Professor Glenn Jeffrey. I hope you enjoyed this whole series. I have learned so much. I am definitely taking steps to get near-infrared light back into my life in a big way. I hope you'll do the same.